This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Iraq gets ready for another election. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Iraqis are getting a taste of American-style campaigning, with TV spots, wall posters, and political machines. Despite threats of violence, Thursday's turnout's expected to be higher than ever, with Sunnis participating this time and a lot at stake for the next 4 years. On To the Point, we'll get a progress report on establishing democracy in the Middle East. We'll hear from Iraqis who are participating in the process. We'll also look at the system they're voting for and the potential for sectarian hostilities that could lead to civil war. On Reporter's Notebook later on, a media witness to California's latest execution. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. Iraqis go back to the polls on Thursday to elect a council that will rule for the next 4 years. On To the Point, we'll hear about American-style campaigning and talk to Iraqis who are part of the process. Will the new government be structured to unify a divided country or increase ethnic tensions that could lead to civil war? On Reporter's Notebook, we'll talk with Steve Lopez of the Los Angeles Times, a media witness to this morning's execution of Stanley Tukey Williams. First, this news update. In Hong Kong today, at least 4,500 farmers clashed with police as the latest World Trade Organization meeting got underway. Most of the protesters were from South Korea, but some came from as far away as Brazil. Pete Engardio is senior writer for Business Week magazine. And Pete, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Why would farmers, so many of them poor, as it would appear, come from so far away to protest in Hong Kong?
That's a good question. I believe that they think that their livelihoods are at stake. It's hard for me to understand, but except in countries like Hong Kong, Taiwan, you have very small, you know, relatively small agricultural sectors. They grow a lot of rice in Taiwan, for example. In Korea, you're growing a lot of crops. They really aren't commercially sustainable if they had to compete in a global market. So this probably would, you know, adversely affect countries like that, because they both would be considered industrial developed countries.
Yeah, some of these farmers from Japan and India as well.
Right, right. And in Japan, too, has been protecting its rice industry for a long, long time. It's seen as almost a religious obligation and something that you do to keep the countryside populated. Whether the Japanese farmers would ever be able to compete on the world market if they had to is highly unlikely. So there is some vested interest, but these are very small segments in these countries. But they're very vocal and they're very politically influential.
Well, put this in context then of the ongoing Doha Round, as it's called. This is the most recent version of it. There were high expectations at the outset, but
right.
Your magazine, Business Week magazine, is reporting, forget it. Not much is going to happen.
No, it's like you've already have the European trade negotiator saying that don't expect any new offers on agriculture. Agriculture is the key to this whole round. You have the French agriculture minister saying that the French will veto any kind of EU commitment that goes outside of the EU system right now. Basically, Europe is offering to cut tariffs a bit, but really what the U.S. is pressing for is like an 80% cut in farm subsidies, which are, you know, to the tune of $350 billion a year in the EU. And the U.S. in return says it will cut our, America's farm subsidies by 60% by 2010, which is a pretty big, would require a pretty big investment of political capital by any politician, any country. But it's already the Europeans have said this is off the table. And without that, there really is nothing of substance that the developing world can really offer to the developing nations, which is what this new round has really come to be all about. The clearest area where they can, where poor nations can't compete, are in agricultural products that are very labor intensive, and are commodity products. And right now, the barriers are just too stiff. The cost of shipping from Africa, say, to Europe, is completely, you know, offset by the subsidies in these countries. So it's just, there's really nothing else to offer. They can send all the manufactured goods they want to our countries, but they're just not competitive in these industries yet.
Pete Ngardio, again, writes for Business Week magazine. Well, what does this mean for the World Trade Organization in general? And doesn't President Bush soon lose his trading authority?
He is, yes, he will. But there's also been a breakdown. The WTO will continue. And these talks, they're going to come up with something to agree on, to say that there is, you know, something, some kind of progress to be made, that we will pick this issue up again in the spring, and in 2 years we'll have another round, and that we've made some kind of progress. Expect that. It'll be seen by everybody as a failure.
What about the United States?
I'm sorry.
I was just going to ask quickly because we're running short of time. What about intellectual property, one of the things the U.S. is most concerned about?
I think that's completely off the agenda right now. It's another one. It's on the American wish list for a long time. But I think the developing nations now have the agenda. They said, we've been doing the giving. We've been opening and opening and opening and opening. Here are still some very important areas that are off limits to us for all practical purposes. You start delivering in the United States and in Europe, then we can start talking about whatever else is left on your wish list. And that, so greater intellectual property is now way down on the agenda. It's not going to happen until somehow there's a breakthrough in agriculture.
So the WTO will continue, you say, even if they're kind of papering over their differences.
Oh, they'll continue to talk for years and years and years and years. But I think it's going to be very hard after the failure. And I think that's what we're looking at right now, is a failure of this round to do anything of real substance. It's going to be hard to take these talks seriously unless there is just a whole new political leadership in both the United States and in Europe that's willing to take these issues on.
All right. Once again, WTO getting off to a shaky start for the Doha round in Hong Kong. Pete Ngardio, thanks a lot for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Senior writer, covers global business and economic trends for Business Week magazine. In a moment, Iraq gets ready for another election on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Alney back with To the Point. Hospital patients, soldiers, prisoners, and expatriates are already voting, but most Iraqis will go to the polls on Thursday. 14 million voters will be able to choose between 7,000 candidates representing 226 political groups. At stake, 275 seats in the Council of Representatives, which will govern Iraq for the next 4 years. After two previous elections this year, Iraqi politics is increasingly sophisticated. That's according to Jonathan Feiner, who's in Iraq for the Washington Post. Jonathan, thanks very much for being with us. What do you mean when you say, as you have in the Washington Post, let me let you elaborate on it, that the process is becoming more sophisticated?
Well, compared to January, you see a sort of a higher quality, graphically speaking, of posters. You see slicker television advertisements. You see parties employing technology like websites that are interactive, text messaging, any means possible to get message out to supporters and potential supporters in a place where traditional campaigning, like going door-to-door and meeting people, is difficult to do because of the security situation.
What about the security? It's my understanding that one candidate who had appeared on television last night was killed today in Ramadi.
That's right. And it's not the first candidate that's been killed. We've heard of at least a few others just in the last couple of weeks in various parts of the country, out west in Ramadi, also up north in Kurdistan. There were some attacks on a party's offices up there and in other parts of the country as well. And it's sort of a specter that hangs over all of this progress that the government and U.S. officials in Baghdad claim is being made by going forward with these elections.
And yet, despite the security situation and the threats from insurgents, it's my understanding the predictions are that the turnout will be much higher than it has been before.
That's what people think, in large part because of the fact that the Sunni Arabs who boycotted Iraq's last elections in January are expected to turn out in much higher numbers. And in fact, there was a statement today posted on the internet by the Al-Qaeda in Iraq group led by Abu Musab Zarqawi, saying that they plan not to attack polling places, not to attack voters, to give Sunnis an opportunity to participate in this election, even though they still said they condemned the political process and condemned the elections. Now, there's no way to immediately verify a statement like that, but it was posted on a website that has previously been credible in terms of releasing reports from the insurgency.
What about the candidates that have the biggest names, the ones we have heard of here in this country, like Alawi, who was president during the interim government, and others? When there are 225 different organizations or 226 political groups campaigning, which are the ones that have the biggest images?
Well, a lot of people think that the elections are going to break down much along the same lines that they did last time, with the Shiite Muslim religious parties winning the lion's share of the vote, and those the candidates at the top of those lists are the people that we've probably heard of a lot lately, the Prime Minister of Iraq, Ibrahim Jaafari, a relative newcomer to the political scene, at least from the point of view of most Americans. You probably haven't heard of him, is a man named Abdul Mehdi, who many people think is a likely prime ministerial candidate. Ayad Alawi is leading his own slate that's a rival of that Shiite religious coalition, and is hoping to do better than he did in the last elections when he got about 12 to 14% of the seats and of the votes.
He is a secular candidate, as I understand it. What about the Sunnis? Do they have a major party that extends across the interior boundaries of Iraq and is nationwide?
There are several Sunni slates running this time, which is, as I said before, the biggest change compared to the last election. There's one group led by the Iraqi Islamic Party, which is a Sunni Arab religious party that's probably the largest Sunni party in the country, very well organized, and is really geared up for this election. And then there are other slates led by Sunnis who are considered by the U.S. officials here to be somewhat more hardline, people who reject the political process but are running in an attempt to sort of change things from the inside for the first time. And that's a positive development that they're getting involved in the process, but there's certainly the hope from people on the U.S. side that they're not going to win a whole lot of seats.
All right. We're talking with Jonathan Finer, Washington Post, a foreign correspondent in Baghdad, about the campaign there. Let me turn to Imam Ahmed Kamas, who is a volunteer humanitarian aid worker who lives in Baghdad. She has also worked as an interpreter, and I want to thank you very much for being on our program.
Thank you.
You are not directly involved in the process, as I understand it. You're not an election worker. You're a volunteer humanitarian aid worker. So tell us from your standpoint, what does all of this look like to you? What do you see in the streets of Baghdad that you haven't seen before? And how are people talking that's new?
Well, the most obvious thing that we can see in Baghdad these days is the too many posters on the walls. There is literally no wall in Baghdad that is not covered by many posters for many candidates. And sometimes there are many posters put on top of each other, so they hide the ones that are below them. And actually, Baghdad streets are becoming even more and more dirty because of these too many posters. On TV, there are many programs and many debates, many things about this election. It's like a farce. It's farcical because candidates are attacking each other, and they are accusing each other of fraud. For example, in the last election and the last referendum, they are accusing each other of corruption, of stealing money, of misuse of the power, etc., etc. And I'm talking about the big names, you know. Because in this election, there are two or three major players, and there are too many names, there are too many list numbers. I don't know how the Iraqis are going to choose between these people, because actually there is no clear political program for anyone of these candidates, of these people. They talk very much, and all the talk is just rhetoric, because they talk about Iraq development, about security, about what they are going to do in the future if they are elected. But no one of them at all said what is he going actually to do to develop Iraq, to achieve security, to whatever they are talking about. So it's a very big confusion, and also there are many, many jokes, and many people are really, they don't look at it very seriously, but they just look at it as part of the whole confusion that's going on in Iraq.
Do you think, despite all of the problems that you have outlined, that even so, a lot of people will turn out to vote?
Yes, I think many people are going to vote. That's true. Actually, there are many things that happened. Like, for example, we hear, of course, we are not sure of anything. We hear that many people are being paid. We know and we see on TV big meals and big meetings being held in different parts of Iraq. And they are funny. I mean, the people, they talk about their political attitude or their political position now are very, not convincing at all. These people, many of them we don't know. We never heard about in the past. We don't know who they are, what is their history, what is not political, just general history. And the ones that we already know and we have already tried in the last almost 3 years, they failed in everything. They are not trustworthy. So I don't know. I mean, but it's true. I mean, many people are going to go, I think. It's strange what's going on. I mean, because the major factor in the whole political process in Iraq now, and what's going on in Iraq now, the major factors are being neglected, are not being talked about. These candidates, they talk about violence. What violence? I mean, for example, they don't tackle the most important thing. They don't tackle the existence of hundreds of thousands of foreign troops on the land of Iraq. I mean, this is the major reason why there is, as they say, violence or insurgency, as you called it, or resistance. So what they are going to do about this? Because this is the major thing. None of them at all talked about what they are going to do about these troops.
All right. Thank you very much. Again, Iman Ahmed Hamas is a volunteer humanitarian worker in Baghdad who also has worked as an interpreter, as you can see. Her English is eloquent. I want to go back to Jonathan Feiner, the Washington Post correspondent in Baghdad. Does what we're hearing from Ms. Hamas seem to you to reflect the feeling of many Iraqis, that the process is confusing, that the candidates aren't really talking about the issues that people want to hear about most, particularly the removal of foreign troops?
Well, I would agree with a lot of what she said, but I would also add the fact that I think that a lot of the criticisms that have been made of the process are ones that are also made of democratic processes all over the world. The fact that candidates lack sort of specificity in terms of plans and issues and are too inclined towards mudslinging, with the one exception of the fact that in Iraq you have this added dimension of political violence, which is not common to obviously the democratic systems everywhere. But certainly it's a confusing process. Certainly there are many, many, many candidates and many, many different parties. But I think to a very large extent, probably more so than in a place like the United States, Iraqis are getting guidance on who to vote for and how to vote from people that they trust, from places like mosques, leaders like religious clerics, and are very sort of trusting in those systems of advising to sort the muddle.
Again, Jonathan Finer is with The Washington Post. Our next guest we're introducing as Jim because for security reasons he can't use his whole name. He is country director in Iraq for the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs. That's a nonprofit based in Washington, which is consulting with political parties in Iraq to help them mount their campaigns. He joins us now from Baghdad. And Jim, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Warren. Good to be here.
What do you say to what Jonathan Finer just said, that the kinds of complaints we're hearing from Iman Ahmed Hamas are true of democracies around the world? What does that suggest about the process that's now being introduced into this country?
Well, I think what you've got to look at is how far along, frankly, Iraq has come in a very, very short period of time. If you think back even 12 months, they hadn't even had the first election yet. Our work with political parties has indicated they are finally beginning to get to understand what it means to campaign. They've become much more active. They're getting a little more mature and sophisticated in their approach to being elected. They're actually trying to be creative about getting out the vote, voter targeting, political engagement of women in the political parties, message development. So, you know, democracy is really a very long-term goal that a lot of countries try to achieve. And, you know, most Western countries are somewhere down that spectrum. Iraq is just beginning that process. So there's going to be transitional challenges, as there is for any country. But we've seen a pretty major shift and change and improvement just over the last less than a year since January.
But when someone as educated and informed as Iman Ahmed Hamas says, too many wall posters all on top of one another, television programs where people debate but they don't really deal with substantive issues, charges of fraud and corruption, and no real indication of what they intend to do once they get in office, what sort of image of democracy does that suggest?
Well, it sounds pretty similar to a lot of countries around the world, frankly. There's posters on the wall. There are political debates on television. There are political ads going on. I think one has to manage expectations here a little bit. Most Iraqis that we work with are getting a little impatient. They see this spirit of democracy building. It's still in a very violent atmosphere. But yet Iraqis every day, especially in January with the election, with the constitutional referendum, and with what's coming up on Thursday, will take their lives in their hands and they will go and vote because they think it's important. That to us is at least a small baby step forward down this road. I agree completely that one of the changes that definitely need to be taken is the candidates need to talk about more grassroots issues. They are slowly but surely beginning to do that. Another challenge, as she mentioned, is because of the lists, the closed lists, the way the system's working, not very many Iraqis know the individual candidates that are on the list. She's correct. But I think what's going to happen, we've been working with interim governments since the last year and a half, especially the last, you know, 12 months or so. Iraqis are beginning to realize that the next government they elect will be a full-time, four-year parliament in which I think they're going to start holding their elected members a lot more accountable than they have been. And we're beginning to see a lot of activity down the road.
All right, Jim, once again, county director in Iraq for the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs. We're going to take a brief break. Then we're going to continue this conversation on Reporter's Notebook later. We'll talk with a media witness to California's latest execution, and we'll talk about what it accomplished. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
We're finally back with To the Point, once again talking about the Iraqi election. Hospital patients, soldiers, prisoners, expatriates already are voting. Most Iraqis, however, will go to the polls on Thursday. We've just heard Jim from the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs, who's advising in Iraq, say that there is a spirit of democracy abroad in the country and that that has been developed in a very short time. I want to go back to Iman Ahmed Hamas, our volunteer humanitarian aid worker. worker in Baghdad. You said earlier that you were one of those very frustrated with this process, didn't feel that people knew the candidates because, of course, their names aren't all known because of the security issues. What does the phrase spirit of democracy mean to you at this point?
Well, it means a very bad joke, not only to me, by the way. The word democracy in Iraq now is a joke. I mean, whenever you go on the street and cafes and whatever, when some kind of odd thing happens, people say, oh, this is democracy, isn't it? No, what's going on in Iraq now has nothing to do with democracy. I don't know, by the way, I don't know what is the meaning of democracy at all, because I see and I read going on in Europe and U.S., etc. I don't know what is the meaning of this word.
Let me interrupt you for a moment, if I may, then. Excuse me for doing that. But if that's the case, if democracy is a joke, if it's a farce, as you said earlier, why do you think, then, that so many people plan to vote?
Well, for many reasons. One of the reasons is that, unfortunately, the occupation helped in dividing the Iraqis in many sections. So many people are turning to the balloting centers not for political reasons, not because they think that these candidates are going to do something good for the Iraqis, but because this candidate is a Shi'i, or this candidate is a Kurd, or this candidate is Sunni. And they think, these people who are going to vote, they think that if the Shia are going to, for example, win, or if the Sunnis, or if the etc., they are going to help them personally to get jobs. Or help them personally to get some kind of benefit. And of course, every party, every political party, every group has their own people, their own supporters. So everyone is thinking that if he supports the people who he belongs to, he's going to be benefit personally.
All right. Iman Ahmed Khamas, again, a volunteer aid worker in Baghdad. Back to Jim with the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs. That probably sounds familiar to a lot of people as well. But one of the things that has been raised as an issue of concern is that if people vote as Shiites, as Sunnis, as Kurds, that what we'll see in Iraq is a perpetuation of perhaps even an intensification of sectarian rivalries that could be very dangerous.
There is that possibility. I mean, we're not naive here. This is Iraq. There's a lot to be. There's a lot that's very positive going on, but they're still got years ahead of themselves. But the fact that we're actually having this discussion, the fact that the mosques are actually saying, "Go out and vote." And the people are going out to vote, and that political parties are rallying their voters and core supporters to go out and vote. I mean, it's not unheard of in other countries. That is the basis of an electoral system. You vote for who thinks what party can do the best for you in some way. So it does get very personal in a lot of ways. She is right that a lot of the issues are only just beginning to be talked about. Could it get worse sectarian? Possibly, but I think one big caveat is the very active involvement of Sunnis this election and this time around as opposed to January. And I think what you're going to see when the dust settles from the certification of the voting results by the Independent Electoral Commission for Iraq is a little bit more of a rebalancing between Sunnis, other secular Democrats, coalitions such as former Prime Minister Alawi's, the Kurds, and the Shia Alliance. I think they're going to be forced in a position pretty well that they're going to have to start forming coalitions to get things done. That's kind of forming a basis of democratic development and brokerage politics.
And when you say talk about the certification of the election results, how long do you think that will take to count the vote and certify it as accurate after the voting takes place on Thursday?
Well, the ICI is making comments that it may not take more than a few days, but having gone through the last election and the referendum, I think I wouldn't hold your breath until maybe another couple of weeks after that. There are logistical issues, frankly, just mere logistical issues in getting ballot boxes from one place to the other in Iraq because many of the roads are shut down, the borders are closed, et cetera. So there's a logistical issue of physically moving and securing the ballots in and of themselves. And then, there's 14 million Iraqis or around 14 million Iraqis qualified or registered to vote. That's, and they've got to all be counted by hand. So there are logistical issues in that. So, you know, the ICI, I think, may be a bit optimistic, but they're taking their time and they're trying to ensure transparency in the process, which, frankly, is much more important than trying to get the thing done in a couple of days.
Again, Jim is the director in Iraq for the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs. John Alterman is director of the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, organization that's nonpartisan and a foreign policy think tank in Washington. And John Alterman, thank you for being with us.
Pleasure to be with you.
You've been listening to this conversation as we have been going along. I'm interested in your take on the difference between what we're hearing from Iman Ahmed Hamas and from Jim, the glass is half empty, the glass is half full. What exactly are you concerned about the most as Iraqis go to the polls, and what are they going to be left with at the end of the election? What sort of new structure will the government have?
Yeah, I think we're definitely looking at the same glass, and the question is what's inside the glass? The question, it seems to me, is not what the actual election returns are, but what the election results are. What do you do with the map you have of parties and strength to try to create a government? What Sunnis do you bring in? How many people do they bring along with them? I think one of the really long-term dangers in Iraq is that you have an alliance between the North and the South, and people in the middle of the country, which also has the capital, feel like they're having their country stolen away from them. What really matters is, can this political process make everybody feel like they have a voice and they have a stake, or is this political process leading toward the country falling apart? And I think that's a lot of what we heard Iman talking about. This is a content-free election. It's about people getting their guys out, and what happens behind closed doors as they put together a government is anybody's guess.
To what extent is the new parliament and its relationship to the executive and the judiciary structured in such a way that it's liable to exacerbate the tensions that you mentioned between the North, the South, and the center with, for example, the distribution of oil royalties?
Well, first, the parliament is much stronger than the executive, so which is unlike many places in the world. So the parliament is going to have remarkable strength, and we just don't know how that parliament's going to be set up. The way the Constitution is written, and the Constitution is still subject to amendment, but the way it's currently written, the central government has access in a sharing arrangement with current oil wells. But when people discover new oil, that money goes to regional governments. What that threatens to do is to starve the central government and reward certainly the Kurdish area in the north and possibly a Shia area in the south if they split off. And then the question, as I say, is you have a capital with perhaps a quarter or more of the people in the country, all the elites, and they're saying everything that we have built, everything that we've been drawing on, is being taken away from us. It's a mixed area, and I think we could be looking at a relatively well-off north in the short term, a relatively well-off south, and incredible chaos and violence in the middle.
If, in fact, there is a stress between the various sectarian organizations, they are, as I understand it, probably all going to be represented in both the parliament and the executive. But who would there be anybody, the president, the prime minister, who could really take over the situation and be in a position to impose order?
I say first we start with the fact that it's a relatively weak executive, so the president and the prime minister doesn't really have that capacity. But the other question, I think it's a very serious and penetrating one we haven't really dealt with. Why has there been no real national leadership emerging in Iraq? And you'd sort of think that this vacuum would create an opportunity for people to come in and rise and make great leaders. And in fact, what we see is people seem to be retreating more and more to their sectarian identifications. And it seems to be leading the country away from a unified future rather than toward one.
John Alterman with the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Let me go back to Jim, the country director for the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs. The structure, again, of the government seems to be a real issue, and there was talk in order to get the Sunnis involved of the possibility of amending the Constitution once the parliament was constituted. What do you think of the prospects for that?
Well, I think what you've got, I mean, I think in the end it was the right thing to do, although I think the Iraqi Islamic Party, which kind of bit the bullet a couple of days before the referendum, which was a Sunni party, and signed on to it, took a huge risk. And the polls will tell whether it was a successful move or not.
Whose party is the Iraqi Islamic Party? What does that mean in terms of leadership and names we know?
It's a Sunni party that it's probably the largest Sunni party, frankly, that's in Iraq currently. They are going to actively campaign in this election, as others, and they've actually formed a coalition with a number of other parties. I think what you've got, there was no other way to turn really on the Constitution. They will strike an amending committee as soon as possible, I think, once the new parliament is sworn in. There are numerous elements of the Constitution that will be up for amendment, and I think there'll be a concerted effort now that the Sunnis will be officially represented in Parliament and on this amendment committee, that there's going to be some hard bargaining and negotiating going on prior to the next constitutional referendum, likely, early summer, midsummer.
Again, Jim, with the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs, let me go back to Iman Ahmed Hamas, our voluntary humanitarian aid worker living in Baghdad. Interested in your take on what you're hearing about the description of your own election. Do you think that most voters understand the kinds of complexities and subtleties that we've been talking about for the last 10 minutes?
I don't think so. Not many people understand. I mean, not many people know the mechanism of things. They just know they go to the balloting center and they choose this person or that person. That's the only thing they know. And I think many of them know that the elections are not going to be honest 100%. Many people, many Iraqis know that for sure from the last two experiences, which are the election of January and also the referendum. Many people do not expect, as President Bush said, actually, he said that the violence will not stop. It will continue after the elections. Not only violence, I think the bad situation of Iraq is going to go on because the same people who run Iraq for the last 3 years are the same people who are now candidates for the election. So whoever is going to win, I don't think he's going to be capable of solving the problems. The two gentlemen who talked, we just talked now, and they are giving very good analysis of the political things, etc. We don't see these things in our lives. I mean, you are talking about democracy and political process going on, but why is it that with all this democracy and political changes and political development, that our life is getting worse and worse every day? And it's not that I'm saying that because I am in a humanitarian emergency relief, etc. I mean, generally speaking, for the Iraqis, men and women, you can ask anyone on the street, ask him, what do you think? Is it better now or worse? I will tell you 100%, even if they are involved in the political process, even if they are pro-occupation, even they will say that it is worse.
Let me go back to Jim with the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs. It's a tough commentary on what's happening, especially after all the work that you have done there, training monitors and trying to teach people the process and so on. If a lot of people feel, as Iman Ahmed Hamas does, and she says both your analyses are very good of what's going on in Iraq, how concerned are you that people's patience is going to run out with this amendment process to the Constitution and all of the procedural issues that apparently will have to be resolved by the new parliament?
Let me state right off the top that, I completely understand her comments, and they're very heartfelt. Iraqis have been through hell for a very, very, very long time, and they're being expected to become a little more optimistic towards their future in a very, very short period of time. And it's tough. It's very, very tough. I think there is a level of frustration out there. I will tend to disagree just a little bit with one of her comments. If you look at a number of the polls that have been released, and that's not to say that polls are 100% accurate, especially in Iraq, but there's been a number of polls released lately that do indicate that the average Iraqi is feeling that things are getting a little better. They are starting to focus more and more on things, the grassroots issues like electricity, unemployment, health care. They're still focused on security, but they're now going down to things that make a tremendous difference to their everyday lives. My previous comment, where I said that they're going to hold accountable, I think, in a much tougher way, their new elected members. I don't think if the new members do not move quickly and positively in trying to rectify a number of the issues that are sitting out there that she alluded to, they're going to be somewhat disillusioned. But
on that note, let me go back to John Alderman at the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. What do you think in terms of a time frame here after the parliament is elected? Obviously, people are concerned about electricity, unemployment, health care, the other kinds of bread and butter issues that Jim just mentioned and that Iman Ahmed Hamas talked about as well. To what extent are the same people who are running the country now going to be able to resolve the differences we've seen already, and how long do you think it'll take them?
Well, they've not been able to resolve the differences up to now. It seems to me that if Iman thinks that right now they're in a period of darkness about what's happening politically, they're about to enter a period of real deep darkness, because what really is going to matter are the backroom negotiations over who's in the coalition, who's out, and what they get for being in or what they want, which ends up keeping them out. That process, I think, is likely certainly to take many weeks and possibly months, and then we go into the four-month period of uncertainty with the amendment process to the Constitution. I was just talking to somebody close to the Kurds last night who said the Kurds will not accept any changes on the where the money goes for oil in the Constitution. So we're going to have probably 6 months or more of real political uncertainty before people get down to the four-year task of actually governing the country.
All right. We are going to leave it at that for the moment. We'll try to keep touch, of course, with the electoral process as it unfolds, already is unfolding, I should say. And again, most Iraqis will go to the polls on Thursday. Thank you all. John Alterman with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Jim in Iraq for the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs, Iman Ahmed Hamas, their voluntary humanitarian aid worker in Baghdad. Thank you very much for being with us. And thanks to Jonathan Finer, Washington Post foreign correspondent in Baghdad, our earlier guest on this program. At 12:01 this morning, Pacific time, Stanley Tukey Williams was put to death by the state of California. After Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger refused to grant clemency yesterday afternoon, last-minute court appeals were turned down. Williams died by lethal injection at San Quentin Prison. In a moment, we'll hear from a media witness on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Warman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Stanley Tukey Williams was the 12th man executed in California since capital punishment was reinstated in the late 1970s. But his case won international attention because he campaigned from death row against the violent gang life that he once lived. There were 39 witnesses this morning, including 17 from the media. Steve Lopez is a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Steve, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Why do we have media witnesses? What were you doing there?
Well, I had to ask myself that question after I innocently tossed my name into the ring a couple weeks ago, not really expecting to get selected and not knowing exactly what my purpose was. And you're forced to do some soul searching as the moment approaches. And I suppose I wanted to bear witness in the end. I wanted to be able to see this with my own eyes and perhaps address the subject with a little more authority and experience in the future. So I think that's why I was there. I think that we ought to see, and we ought to tell people what we see.
What did you see in terms of the execution itself and the response of the other 38 people who were witnesses as well?
It got fairly dramatic. This was my first one. Those who have witnessed many among my media colleagues said that this one was more dramatic in the sense that, Mr. Williams kept lifting his head up off the table, looking at his executioners, looking at the people in the audience. If you could imagine this, we're in a sort of a small auditorium, and the stage is the death chamber, and we're looking through glass panels from maybe 12 feet away. and we can see him, and he can see us. And he watched them try to tap a vein, which they had great difficulty doing, particularly on his left arm, for the lethal injection. They just worked on it, and it seemed like 10 minutes that stretched into eternity. And he seemed to be looking at them as if to ask, you know, don't you people know what you're doing? And then he would look at the he looked at the press once, just kind of stared at us. Some folks thought that it was an intimidating glance. I didn't take it that way. I just thought that he was looking at this, you know, this show around him. These were the last people he would see. For the most part, he looked over to the left, his left, to his supporters. And there were people who, you could see, mouthing the words, God bless you, we love you. There were raised fist salutes, and Tukey, even after they administered the drugs that would kill him, was, you know, trying to lift his head up and look around the room. And when it was over, three of his supporters on the way out said, California just killed an innocent man. And that was additionally dramatic because there were in the room family members of Tukey's victims. And one woman, I didn't see this, but a colleague with a better view said that one of these family members burst into tears. So the whole thing was dramatic, creepy, macabre, medieval almost.
You said you wanted to bear witness, and all of us who, of course, are participants by virtue of being citizens, I suppose, need to know these things. What about the administration of the chemicals that killed him? Did he appear to endure pain, and was that a prolonged process or not?
It seemed as though the really, you know, there's something clinical and easy and medicinal about it. You get a shot and you go to sleep. That part didn't appear to be much of a problem for him. I mean, easy for me to say. What was gripping was his walk to the death chamber. You don't see much of it, but you see him appear, and he did so without resistance, with five or six guards at his side in case he tried to resist. He didn't resist. He climbed up onto this, looks like a converted dental chair. He lay on his back. They strapped him down, feet, legs, upper body. All of that part, the deliberation at the hands of the government are what I found striking. I walked into that chamber opposed to the death penalty, but unconvinced that Tukey had redeemed himself. I just didn't buy the mythologized Tukey. And I think, you know, those who oppose the death penalty keep picking the wrong poster children for their cause. He was a bad guy. And I don't think there was much doubt about it. And in the end, he didn't take responsibility, nor did he do a good enough job, I don't think, of asking that there be no violence in his name. But here is this man who, you know, I'd be content as a citizen to have him spend the rest of his natural life locked up with his regrets and haunted by his deeds. And it seems to me an unnecessary extra step for the government to walk this man to his death and kill him at a time when, I think since, 1990, 40 nations in the world have abolished the death penalty. 12 states don't have it. And here we are still killing people. I'm not sure what we gained with the execution of Tukey last night.
Steve Lopez, again, is columnist for the Los Angeles Times, so one of the 17 media witnesses among the 39 witnesses who were there at San Quentin Prison when Stanley Tukey Williams' life was taken by the state of California. Well, you said you were opposed to the death penalty going in. Obviously, you're opposed to it now. What do you intend to do in terms of bearing witness then? And as you said at the outset, addressing this situation with more authority than you had before, how will this change your approach to it?
I think that I'm going to be more inclined to write about it, and I'm going to be more inclined to look for better poster, better people to carry the banner.
Let me just say in that context, though, that I've read a lot of the cases of people who have been convicted of murder and who have been given the death penalty. It's pretty hard to find anybody that's very sympathetic.
Well, yes, but, you know, we've got, 122 people now who have been exonerated or granted new trials, death row inmates. Did we make a mistake 122 times? And if so, how many mistakes did we make before that? And why risk a mistake? No, these are not good guys, but I don't know what we get You know, additionally, in the way of justice or satisfaction, to have the state execute them, and there's something very strange about the final moments when the injection is done and you sit and you watch this man die. And he dies, you asked earlier, you know, does he any signs of pain? No, none at all. He closes his eyes, he stops breathing, and that's the end of it. And it's almost as if, you know, we used to do it by gas chamber and, you know, by hanging, and now we do it this way out of humanitarian concerns. I think it's more for our sake than for the man who's put to death. I think it's more for us to be more comfortable with our support in this nation of the death penalty. And maybe, you know, I mean, it would almost be better to go back to the more primitive ways, so we'd have maybe just a more in-touch notion of what's going on here. We are killing a man.
Does it allow us to be in denial? Is that what you're suggesting?
I think so. I think, you know, it's like, well, you know, what was so bad about this? He got a shot. He went to sleep. Look at what he did to the people that he killed. He shotgunned them. That's true. I mean, this was a bad guy. But there's just something extra creepy about executions by lethal injection, because it's just this quiet thing in the end.
We're going to have to leave it at that. Steve Lopez, again, columnist for the Los Angeles Times, was present again at the execution of Stanley Tukey Williams earlier this morning. Steve, thanks a lot for being
with
us.
Thank you.
Today's program produced by Jonah King, with Christian Bordahl and Andrea Brody, technical director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced by Alive as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and PRI.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.